Welcome back to another edition of Cohen's Corner. This week, we are very excited to have on sports talk radio host Lori Rubenson, who has had her own show on WFAN on Sunday nights for 14 years. And I can say that I have listened to her for almost that entire time since I was a kid. We are so excited to have her on to talk all things Mets. We might sprinkle in a little Yankees, talk some New York sports, because I know Lori knows New York sports better than just about anyone. So Lori Rubenson, we are very excited to have you on. So thank you so much for coming on the show with us today.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
Awesome. And so one thing we like to do when we have guests, especially guests who, you know, have worked in kind of the sports media industry for a while, is we kind of want to get to know how you got started in your current profession. So kind of want, if you wouldn't mind taking us back to how you actually got started in sports talk radio and then maybe how you landed at WFAN, that would be awesome. Because, you know, I know everyone has kind of a different story of how they've migrated through the industry. So I'm curious to hear kind of from your perspective, how you've gotten to where you are today.
Well, I'll start by saying my career path is weird and not anything that I would ever say to anybody. You can follow this. Is I actually had gone to graduate school at Wharton and graduated and was working in marketing. And I always have thought, though, that this was something, working somehow in sports and sports broadcasting, sports media, was something that I wanted to do. You know, always loved sports, and it was a real passion and something that was sitting there in the back of my mind. And anyway, I did end up then having an opportunity, fast forward. I mean, honestly, I went out for a ESPN reality show called Dream Job and got an agent through that. And then, you know, stopped the marketing thing for a while and took all kinds of jobs, whether they were freelance jobs. And ultimately, I landed an opportunity with WCTC Radio in Central Jersey, 1450. And it's a station that covers all Rutgers sports. So Rutgers, you know, football and men's and women's basketball, and had a co-host. And we did a show. And when we first started, honestly, we weren't getting paid. So it was truly a labor of love, and I was having to do other jobs and things to support it. And then when we were getting paid, it wasn't a lot. But I got an opportunity to have a meeting with Mark Chernoff, which if anybody follows WFAN, he's the guy who basically was, you know, hired all the talent forever for everybody who worked on the station. And I wasn't ready yet for WFAN. But I then, and, you know, and I guess maybe that is the, if there's a message for people to follow, it would be, if it is something you want to do, have belief and have some persistence. And so I kept reaching out to Mark, and I would send him, just some of my work, send him some of my shows and send him things through the months and through a period of a few years. And finally, one day, he got back. I mean, he would give me, he was actually really kind, and he would give me feedback and critique on my work. And then he just one day reached out and said, "Hey, I haven't forgotten you. And do you want to have an audition?" And it was Memorial Day, I think, from like 3 to 6 a.m. Memorial Day, where he felt like I couldn't do too much damage. And gave me an opportunity, and from there thought I was pretty good and just kept giving me shows and things until I finally got my own show. So anyway, that's the story of it. But I would say that if it's what you want to do stuff like what you guys are doing. You just keep at it, and you keep meeting people, and you keep sending your work to different people, and you get feedback, and then you never know where it leads.
Wow, that's a crazy story. I don't know if anybody really like has gone the career path that you've gone, like the route you've taken. So that's really unique. That's amazing. But I'd love to go back. You mentioned your start with on ESPN's Dream Job. And can you kind of just take us through that experience and what that was like to kind of show your face for the first time on that? Like, that's got to be pretty surreal.
Yeah, so I lined up in Times Square with like thousands of other people to audition. They auditioned at like 29 sites around the country. It was the first season of it. It ultimately, I think, was a flawed concept for them, but they did a couple seasons of it. And yeah, the one thing I'll say is a reality show that you know, for people, this was the early days of them. And I would say that the thing to know about a reality show is they're not really real. They're edited. And so they're trying to fabricate all this tension between people and stuff like that. And that's why I think it didn't really work long-term for ESPN, because it was to win a spot to be a SportsCenter host. And what I know from my marketing career and marketing side of things is you can't screw with the brand. And to do a reality show really well, it has to kind of get ugly and nasty, and people have to, you know, bitch and moan about each other. And we all liked each other. And they were, you know, they wanted us to say bad things about each other, things like that. So it really didn't make for probably as great television, because I think they had to ultimately protect the brand. And so anyway, but what I did, I will say, is I had an opportunity to meet and work with in that time with the late Stuart Scott from ESPN. And for those people who knew or followed him or were fans of his, I can tell you, you know, he was extremely kind, just a really kind guy who, you know, and we met other personalities, you know, Linda Cohen and others or whatever, but Stu Scott was the host of the show. And he just was, he didn't have to be, he was better off camera than on camera in terms of being a good person, just a really good guy.
Yeah, it's funny. I think, you know, you mentioned, I feel like every good reality show kind of needs a villain. And you know, speaking of villains, I don't know if he really made himself out to be a villain, but one thing Jake and I did kind of want to talk about is this whole Steve Cohen tweet that's been kind of making the rounds in terms of people, all sorts of people have opinions on it. And, you know, one thing we were kind of saying before this is that, you know, it's been basically, you know, our entire lives until now, the Mets ownership has been had no transparency whatsoever. And so here we have an owner who is being transparent and people have a lot of thoughts on it. So I guess I'm kind of wondering, you know, the message he was conveying was essentially the team's offense has severely underperformed. And the channel he chose to do it in was via a tweet. And I guess I'm just wondering, do you think that's A, an appropriate message for the team's owner to be putting out there? And B, do you think via Twitter was kind of an appropriate channel for him to communicate this? Because, you know, the team, at least I don't think they should be immune from getting criticism because they have not performed on the field. But I guess I'm just wondering your take on if you think this is something that is really beneficial to either Steve Cohen or just the Mets front office in general to kind of have these thoughts broadcast in this manner.
So the sports talk radio host in me would say he owns the team and he's allowed to say you spend $2.4 billion. You can say whatever you want and you can put it out in any medium that you want. And if Twitter is and seems to be his chosen one and he's behaving and venting like a fan, then certainly he can do that. The marketer in me and business person in me would say, stepping back, what is your desired effect and end goal here? And big picture, my concern would be that when Steve Cohen bought the team and had that first news conference and talked about what he was trying to build, there was something so optimistic about it. And it made it feel like the Mets would become a model organization where players would choose to come play here. Free agents would gravitate. It wouldn't just be the Mets can have to spend way more than everybody else to attract a free agent, because they are LOL or, you know, same old Mets, ha, 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 that they were building something that could be special. And when the owner then tweets criticism of the team in that way, I think that my question would be, is that at odds with trying to make this a more attractive destination for other players and free agents?
Yeah, I get both sides of the argument, I understand. I mean, Elizabeth, like you were saying, for how many years did we just want the Wilpons to be transparent and act like they loved our team? You know what I mean? Like, Mets fans have wanted that for such a long time. So the fact that we have that with Steve Cohen now, I mean, I don't know. Like, it's great. I love it. But you're right. If it sends that wrong message to the team because you're alienating the team, and yeah, if a player sees that and, you know, you get enough from the fans here, do you want to really be hearing from it, like, I'm from your owner now on Twitter? I mean, I'm sure that's got to be something that goes through players' minds. But, I mean, so far, so good. I mean, after he tweeted that, the Mets really kind of busted out the other day. But,
yeah. But, you know, look, they went nine innings.
They busted out in the ninth inning.
Yeah.
Yeah, after eight innings of nothing. Let's just put that straight. After bullpen. The starter got knocked out in the second inning. So, I mean, I was happy they won. Am I going to, like, declare the season turned around? Not necessarily, but
yeah, look, a win's a win. At the end of the season, if a miracle happens and this team somehow turns it around and starts to hit and perform much better and find a way to win the division, and we look back and say it was a galvanizing moment, it was a turning point, well, then maybe he's a really smart guy. And that was, you know, the appropriate reaction at the time. I guess we'll find out about that. But I also think that the Mets hitters have completely underachieved and disappointed. The Mets offense has. There's just no way to look at it any other way than that. But as a team, when you look at them, certainly, I think that the front office, it seemed to me, with their approach to the trade deadline, I think they looked at Jacob DeGrom's status, injury status, and said, you know what, without a healthy Jacob DeGrom, we don't necessarily think this team can win a championship this year. And if it cannot win a championship this year, then we don't want to trade away a whole bunch of prospects from the minor leagues. So they kind of took a little bit of a half-pregnant approach to the trade deadline. They felt like they needed to do a little something to appease the fans, but they didn't do everything that they needed to do if you were truly trying to say, hey, we're all in this season. And that's okay to not be all in this season, but if you're not, then there's the owner. Hey, we didn't go all in at the trade deadline because we really didn't think this was like a World Series team, and now you're then calling them out on Twitter. So I'm just not sure if it serves the owner's purpose and the team's purpose long-term. But I find the media person to me, I find it fascinating. It's fun to cover. It's a great story. It's entertaining. And we'll see. Is Steve Cohen got a little George Steinbrenner in him? And is he going to be public with criticizing the team? And will that be motivating?
Yeah, it's interesting because I was watching a podcast that Trevor May was on. He's a regular co-host on this podcast that Chris Rose hosts. Mm-hmm. And it was interesting because he was talking about how he feels like fans are always waiting for this like eureka moment to magically turn things around. And he like, I just feel like it's a lot more of a process. Like, I don't think the players see it that way, at least from what he was saying. Like the players aren't like, I don't think there's like a eureka moment that they necessarily are rallying behind. But I know we've kind of getting tired of them saying that they're working on the process and they trust their process, whatever. But I do kind of think like if I feel like Mets fans or just fans in general of their teams are always waiting for these like magical moments to like turn things around. And that's just not always how it works. Like this tweet from Steve Cohen, like might not turn things around, or even if they do improve, it might just be because the offensive things they were working on suddenly started to click, not because he tweeted something critical. So I guess it's hard to pin anything on something like that. I don't know, but it's interesting hearing from like the players themselves. It's like, well, obviously no matter how much the fans don't want to believe it, like no one wants to win more than they do. And sometimes we forget that, but like they are, it's hard to say because like, I know they are obviously trying, but it's just been a very kind of, you're right, underachieving year in general. And that kind of leads into something else we were wondering, which was, you know, obviously kind of the crux of the Mets issues this year has been their offense from what we've seen. And, you know, I guess from your perspective, like out of these core players that have now been with the Mets for several years, like who do you think is really worth holding on to long-term? And who do you think either isn't as good as maybe we thought they would be, or just would not have a future with the team?
Well, I'll answer that question, but to your point on, just going to go back for a second, to your point on, is there, you know, Trevor May's comment on the galvanizing moment and is there a moment that turns things around? I think that's true because it's a 162 game season. And to say, and players do kind of have to, you know, try to be even keel. But there are those moments that stand out. And sometimes you're right, you look back on them, it's not like maybe everyone knew it at the moment. But in hindsight, you look back and say, Wilmer Flores almost got traded and cried. And it like brought Wilmer, his teammates, the fans, like everybody in this like emotional place together. And I don't know, from there they took off. So sometimes you look at what's going on with the Yankees right now and the trade deadline happens. They bring in some new teammates and it takes a team that was lethargic and even though they're the Yankees, seem to lack conviction, lack belief. And adding those players just injected some confidence, some belief into that team. They carry themselves differently. And suddenly a lineup that may have been pressing, hey, we're in New York City. So a little siren there in the background. But anyway, but a team that was pressing will suddenly stop squeezing the bat so tightly. And, you know, so I think that these things happen and there is such a thing as momentum and belief and a team kind of getting on a roll. And that happens both positively and negatively. In terms of the Mets and where to go from here and evaluating this team and who to keep and who not to, if it were me and I was advising Steve Cohen, or my last name was Cohen and I got to have billions of dollars and give counsel on this, I would, at the end of this season, I would start at the top and I would hire a new head of baseball operations. And Sandy Alderson can either be moved aside to some other business role, whatever. But I have a new head of baseball operations and I'd have that person, they can evaluate Zach Scott. Do you want to keep Zach Scott or do you want a new general manager? And then together, that duo, head of baseball operations and general manager, would make decisions with the organization, starting with choose your manager. Who do you want to be the manager of this baseball team? Who's the right person? And yeah, you can keep some of the coaches, front office, scouts, analytics, development, keep some of the, evaluate everybody who stays and then who's the new talent and new blood that you bring in. And when you get to the players, we've now seen that this is it's a really likable group of guys, I think, at that core in a lot of ways. They're likable players, but there is something to them not quite fulfilling on that promise. And so I would be looking at third base, and I would be looking at assuming that there will be a DH, designated hitter in the National League next season. That means you're going to have at least one outfield spot and third base as two new places to put a new position player in for that lineup. And then for Mike Conforto, I think I would probably give the qualifying offer. And if he wants to take it and come back on a one-year deal and find a role for him, okay, and we'll see. You know, was this just fluky that he was so awful for most of the year? And see what happens there. But otherwise, if he doesn't and he wants to go someplace else, then that would free up basically two outfield spots and third base to upgrade this lineup. And I'd be looking at, you know, trying to bring in players, both in terms of lefty-righty balance when you look at this team, a little too left-handed with some of the key players, and then also just, you know, need a little, you know, the Mets are hard because – it's not like a situation where you're looking at a team and saying, well, they hit, you know, it's the 3-2 outcomes. It's just too much walking, striking out, and hitting home runs. This year, I mean, they're not hitting home runs.
That's what, they don't even hit home runs. They strike out and walk, and, like, that's it.
Right. So it's tough when you're basically, like, 1.5 outcomes. Strike out or maybe a walk. So they need to – I think they need a new hitting coach for sure. And they need to land on and figure out what is their organizational hitting approach. But I want that to come from the head of baseball operations and not necessarily Sandy Alderson. I want that to come from a new regime. And I think that emphasizing contact and not striking out as much, I think the successful teams, Houston Astros and others that score a lot of runs, don't necessarily strike out nearly as much as the Mets. And I do think also, listening to this year's team, I've never heard them say this before. Even earlier in the season, the Mets were actually really successful at home or having a winning record and successful record at home. But Citi Field has gotten into the heads of these players. If for anybody, I know you guys, obviously, as huge followers of the Mets are listening to a lot of the post-game press conferences and interviews with players. It's now numerous players. First one I heard really talk about it extensively was Brandon Nimmo, but now we've heard Kevin Pillar and others. I mean, they are point blank in the open talking about the difficulties of hitting in their ballpark. So that's, you either have to evaluate the ballpark and say, are there changes? Do we need to bring the walls in again? Do we need to do something like that with dimensions? Or do we need to figure out the type of hitter? If there's something to the wind currents or whatever's going on in Citi Field that is unfriendly to home runs, the Mets play 81 games there. Do you need to evaluate the kinds of hitters and players that are going to be a little more successful in that ballpark as you do round out the lineup? So, I mean, those would be some of the questions that I'd really be asking.
Yeah, I agree with you. And to your point about the ballpark, I mean, that reminds me of when you think about the Yankees, Brian Cashman before the season, he didn't really construct the team to hit well in Yankee Stadium. I mean, you have that short porch in right field. Do you think you would have more lefties in the lineup that would be able to take advantage of that? So that, it kind of reminds me of that. And yeah, I mean, in the book that David Wright, we had Anthony DeComo on recently. He talked about the book he has, The Captain, and David Wright writes in the book how Citi Field was in his head and how that really affected him.
Messed him up for like 3 years because he only hit 10 home runs there in 2009, and he thought he failed, even though the ballpark was huge.
It really affected him. So like that could be, that definitely could be a factor. And I mean, they've already brought the walls in so many times. I mean, I don't know what else they could do at this point. You know, I mean, I guess you're right, bring them in again. But there's a lot to address. I think there's a lot to address in this upcoming offseason. That's personnel, like you said, in the front office, in the lineup. I mean, a lot of likable guys, but a lot of likable guys who are severely underperforming. Like Dom Smith could be a 300 hitter. He's hitting 250. Jeff McNeil is swinging at all these first pitches, and I know that's his thing, but it's really not working out too well for him this year. I mean, Nimmo's been great, obviously. Conforto's been this huge disappointment. Alonso's been okay. But I think they have to make some big changes this offseason.
Yeah, I agree. And the – I think that's where my hope is, that some – I think fans will look at and say – they expect the owner's money to go into buying players. And that's true. And that's part of it. But I think a lot of investment in whether it's, more front office personnel, more and better analytics, player development, all kinds of things like that. I think we will see, keep in mind the timing of it. Steve Cohen bought the team. The offseason was already underway, and they were kind of scrambling then. So now they'll have that full, even starting now from an offseason standpoint. He really, I am sure, is thinking about some of the people he wants to talk to. And, the obvious name is Theo Epstein. But whether it's Theo Epstein or somebody else, I think they need to think about who is that head of baseball operations and how do they then want to go about this and really start investing both on the field, off the field, all of it. I'm hoping that Steve Cohen is somebody who has really successfully, professionally built a business, can apply some of those principles to invest in the team.
Yeah, I mean, you're right. I mean, he was talking in his first press conference or one of his first press conferences about how he wanted to build, the East Coast Dodgers, which, like Rome, weren't built in a day. So, definitely... Yeah. He did say, everyone's still talking about how he threw out that 3 to 5 year window. And look, this year won. So if the Mets don't win the World Series or even make the postseason this year, I think his ownership still bodes very well for their future, regardless, honestly, of anything that happens this year, because it does take a while to really create a winning organization. It starts with, instilling a culture and changing the personnel, like we've said, and just gaining the trust of everyone and that he knows what he's doing and is going to do the right thing. So yes, as disappointing as part of the season has been, it's still more optimistic than I felt about the Mets in a while, just because you still feel like, despite the team not hitting, that they're somewhat on the right path. So hopefully that bodes well for either the rest of the season or in the years ahead. But yeah, something else actually, on a slightly different note, I know Jake brought up the Yankees earlier and Brian Cashman and Yankee Stadium. We did kind of want to ask you about something happening with the Yankees now that he's getting some media attention, but hasn't been covered too extensively recently. And that's the whole Clint Frazier situation, because he's been out for a while now with various vertigo and vision issues. And I know he apparently took himself out of a rehab game this week or something with some troubles. And there's not really a timeline for kind of his immediate return, which is kind of concerning because he wasn't doing well earlier this year. And he was kind of finally given that like everyday role to start the year with the Yankees. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, hasn't been able to kind of fulfill that role. So I guess I'm just wondering kind of your take on his situation. And I know we've seen some issues of players that have had concussions that were never the same. You really hope this isn't like one of those situations, but I guess I'm just wondering like maybe what either you think the future for him might be, or I guess just how you might see this playing out based on some other kind of similar injuries among baseball players in the past.
First of all, I would say that Clint Frazier's situation, if I had to give you one word, it would be sad. It makes me sad, is that here's a guy, he's what, 26 years old? And you're right. Last year, finally, and it was the COVID shortened 60 game season, but he had an opportunity to really have a role and showcase his skills, and offensively was a plus hitter, that quick bat that we've been waiting for and hearing about, and even played decent defense, which had been an issue for him after the concussion and bashing into the wall and having some issues there. And so there were so many expectations for him this year. And for the, I saw they are now ruling, saying it's not vertigo, but that it is somehow vision related. And it does seem like whether it's vision and dizziness and things like this, that, they're doing neurological tests and all kinds of things, is that I'm no doctor. So, I'm going to speculate with you here, but don't know, is that it does seem like these could be residual effects from the concussion. And some of the players that come to mind that have had careers cut short due to concussion, and there's, plenty of them, but here's somebody who, unlike, we were talking about the Mets before, Jason Bay. Jason Bay had a real career and a really successful career for a couple of organizations before he ever came to the Mets and had the concussion. And then even after the concussion, while he was never the same player, he did go on to play afterwards. But he had a really successful career before that. So it's not like a concussion has to define Jason Bay. It was a really successful career. Cut a little short maybe, but a successful career. With Clint Frazier, what's so sad is, if it ends now, it's like somebody who was a top prospect, forecasted, somebody we thought would have 10-12 year Major League Baseball career, maybe flirt with being an all-star kind of player, and who now will all that promise and potential. And I know it happens to a lot of people in baseball and like lots of roles in life, are not fair and are challenging, but he may never have a career. So I hope that they'll solve whatever this vision issue is, and that after the season, if it is a vision issue, that like it came this year, it will clear itself up and he can go back to playing the way he did last year. I hope he still has a career in front of him. But yeah, right now, to me, it's sadness. And then the other part of it is, when you see that he took himself out of the game because he, especially if it's vision and you're talking about baseball, imagine 100-mile-an-hour pitch coming at you. If your vision isn't great, that's a really dangerous place to be. So the right thing is to take yourself out of there. I have a hard time when you see fans criticizing someone you see that over social media or other places, fans who are criticizing someone for taking himself out of a game, as if he somehow didn't want to play or was, lollygagging it, when that's, to me, if you ask Clint Frazier where he's happiest and what he'd most want to do, it would be, hey, I want to be out there in left field at Yankee Stadium.
Yeah, it's really sad. And I hope it's not the end of his career because, he had so much promise in front of him. I mean, remember when he was such a top prospect and the Yankees traded, I believe he came over in the Andrew Miller deal, and they just had a lot of hope for Clint Frazier. And I mean, obviously his life is more important than him as a baseball player. So I mean, it kind of reminds me, it's obviously another sport, but David Wilson was a pretty good young running back with the Giants. Yep. And he, I think it was a neck problem he had, but it ended his career. And he could have had a really promising career in front of him. I mean, he showed a lot of talent on special teams. He did a lot of good things and a lot of things well. So, I mean, it kind of has that feel to it. I hope he has – Clint Frazier has a different ending. But, yeah, it's just – it's a really unfortunate situation. But, Lori, that's going to wrap it up with us. Thank you so much for coming on with us. This was so much fun. We'd love to have you on again in the future. And if you could, let our listeners know when they can hear you on WFAN and where they can find you on social media.
So WFAN, most of the year, I'm usually on from 10 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the fan on Sunday nights. And then we're starting to be heading into football season. So football season, NFL season, I'm on after Sunday night football on the fan also until 2 a.m. And that's always fun because I get to be that first voice on the fan that reacts to whatever the day's games were, Giants, Jets, hopefully a little more successful than the recent seasons.
Yeah, hopefully the Giants score more points this year, because I feel like I listened to you a lot last season when you were like, the Giants can't score. I'm like, yeah. So like we'll see. But
you know what, I guess it's like the Mets in that sense.
So. Yeah, all the teams, I feel like all the teams I root for, because I'm also a big Islanders fan and a UVA basketball fan, none of those teams can score, so maybe it's me, I don't know.
I think it's you.
Yeah. I realized I'm the common denominator.
Yeah, it must be. Either you love defense, and I like defense too, but I look at the Giants, and you know, you can't be one of the lowest scoring offenses in the league and expect to win. And just like the Mets,
it's the same thing. It's literally the same.
You can't be with the Mets at the moment,
29th in runs scored.
Yeah. The Pirates and the Rangers are the only two teams in baseball who have scored fewer runs than the New York Mets. And so, you know, that's no way to live. That's no way to win. If you're, you know, all it has to be, imagine if the Mets had a mediocre middle of the pack, call it 16th ranked offense in terms of scoring runs with the kind of pitching. And that's where you would account for and look at their ballpark and say, all right, well, you know what, Citi Field's going to play like that. But with the kind of pitching that then they could, you know, bring to that, you can win with that. But you can't win when you're sitting down there in the basement with the Pirates and the Rangers.
Yep.
So anyway, so people can find me on the fan on Sunday nights on WFAN. And then I'm on a number of channels, but honestly, the best, I always say Twitter is like the world's biggest sports bar, for better, for worse. That is where I end up hanging out mostly in terms of social. So Lori Rubinson, it's at L Rubinson on Twitter is usually the place to find me while I'm watching games.
Awesome. And then you can follow our podcast at Cohen's Corner Pod. You can also follow me on Twitter at NYMFan97. And you can follow Jake on Twitter at Giblin_Jake. So once again, Lori, thank you so much for coming on. I look forward to listening to your Sunday night shows coming up. Like we said, hopefully recounting some more Mets wins the rest of the season. And Jake and I are both Giants fans, so hopefully some Giants wins. Maybe they'll win more than six games.
Big year from Daniel Jones.
Yeah, we're year three. We're waiting. So
so am I. We'll see. Yeah. Hopefully the offensive line will block. Hey, good luck to both of you. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you. Thank you for joining
us. Thank you so much. And thank you guys for listening. And as always, let's go Mets.